Hi, I'm David Sirota, investigative journalist at The Lever, Oscar-nominated writer on the film Don't Look Up, former Bernie Sanders speechwriter, and host of the chart-topping news podcast Lever Time. Each week, our team of reporters at The Lever exposes the events, news, and corruption that often go unreported by corporate media. So if you're looking for a podcast that goes below the surface, listen to Lever Time every week wherever you get your podcasts.
The former president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, is under house arrest as he stands trial for allegedly plotting a coup after losing an election. He's facing a possible 40-year prison sentence.
Things are pretty intense in Brazil in that sense, legally and politically, because of all these events.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll also hear from an American Army vet who worked as a security contractor in the Gaza Strip. He says what he saw there was disturbing.
Bullets are flickering all around the feet, into the berm, over their heads. And then this guy that's there just drops to the ground, and he's not moving.
Plus, a much-loved movie in India gets re-released. Audiences are angry it's not the same.
It's literally regressive to go back in time and bring a story without context to fit into a society that's not the same anymore.
All that and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for making it here today. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip woke up this morning asking themselves once again, where do we go now? After Israel's war cabinet decided to expand the military campaign in Gaza.
Today, we were shocked by the new plan to evacuate all the residents of Gaza City.
Salma Altawil is a mother of four who lives in Gaza City and works for the Norwegian Refugee Council. In a voice memo she sent to The World, Altawil said she and her family are exhausted after nearly 2 years of war.
This plan is inhuman. We are already living in a crisis beyond imagination. I never thought I would see the day when my children dream of just eating a piece of bread or an egg or a fruit. I never imagined that the hardest question would be what we would eat today. What we truly hope for is to wake up from this nightmare as soon as possible.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the new offensive in Gaza will be good for Israel's security, but plenty of Israelis are troubled about what comes next in Gaza. Roby Chen is the father of 19-year-old Itai Chen, who was serving in an Israeli tank battalion near the Gaza border on October 7, 2023. He was taken hostage by Hamas. I spoke earlier today with Roby Chen and asked for his reaction to the Israeli military's plan for expanding its operations in Gaza.
This shows that within the objectives of the Israeli government, the dismantling of Hamas supersedes the release of the 50 hostages, including my son. The IDF chief of staff has claimed that the plan that the government wishes to adopt will put at risk the living hostage as well as the deceased hostages of never finding them. Nevertheless, yes, we know Hamas is to blame and Hamas is a terrorist organization that did unacceptable events on October 7th. But we have a government that represents the people of Israel that was in power on October 7th. And there has been a breach of contract between the people and this government. And they need to fix it. And the way to fix it is finding a way to get these 50 hostages back home.
So what do you think this announcement says about the Israel government's priorities with the war in Gaza?
80% of the people living in Israel, based on polls, agree with the following statement. For the release of the last hostage, not the next hostage, the last hostage, the Israeli people are willing to have a permanent ceasefire. And it's unfortunate, but this government is less listening to the demand of the people. As a U.S. citizen, and my son is also a U.S. citizen, the United States government also has an obligation to me as a U.S. taxpayer.
Some of the hostage families have been saying for months that they felt abandoned. Do you see this announcement by Israel's cabinet about Gaza as a sort of final or definitive confirmation that the hostages do not figure into the government's strategic goals?
I hope to believe that there's still time. There's a window here to maybe bring back both sides to the negotiation table, maybe find a way, because we know that the gaps that existed just 10 days ago are not that significant. But if that is not the case, then, you know, indeed, I think it's time for the international community, not just the United States, but the UK, Germany, and others, to bring all the parties together. You know, we had in the past Camp David, and maybe we need to have that same type of exercise. So the last 22 months have shown that the families, the hostage families, are collateral damage, and it is not that critical to maybe get out all the hostages out. That's just a feeling we have.
So with no urgency seemingly from the Israeli government around hostages or the starvation that's happening in Gaza, is there an overall sense of impotence that you and other Israelis are feeling? And how do you deal with that?
Well, I think it's more frustration. There is international support for us. We understand that it is difficult, but you know, this is what we ask for any politician. You know, you need to step up and find a way to get it done.
Robbie, is bringing back the remains of hostages, alive or dead, from October 7th, is it a moral obligation, both to Israel and to the hostage families? And to whom does that argument need to be made?
Well, it's also something that the United States cares a lot about. The Department of Defense, even today, send out teams to Vietnam to find the remains of U.S. soldiers that were killed in Vietnam. It's also a religious aspect. You know, the Jewish faith sees the soul inside of the body, where the body is a vessel, that the soul continues onwards. And in the United States, we say rest in peace. What does that mean? It means that the soul needs to find the resting place. And at the moment, those hostages that were killed are not in a resting place.
Do you see a military takeover of Gaza achieving these goals?
Just being one-dimensional, I think, has proved to be ineffective. I think there needs to be a combination of efforts. And I just hope to believe that the United States also recognizes that, and that the president and his team that have met me personally understand that there needs to be maybe a better plan out there to bring both sides to the table and hash out a deal that brings to the end of suffering of the people in Gaza, as well as the people that have family members that are being held hostage in very inhumane conditions in Gaza for 22 months.
Robi Chen's son Itai was taken hostage on October 7th, 2023. Lebanon is just starting to recover from its war with Israel, on top of dealing with political turmoil and economic collapse. Through all the uncertainty, one man just kept walking, literally. Gilbert Mukhaiber is developing a network of long-distance hiking trails. They pass through less-traveled parts of the Lebanese countryside. He started the project during the pandemic. The World's Shirin Jafari recently spoke with Mukhaiber about what he's trying to do.
A local shepherd puts the finishing touches to a trail marker at one of the highest points in Lebanon. He adds the red and white paint to a boulder, marking it for future hikers who he hopes will come to this area. This is one of Mukhaiber's posts on social media, documenting his five-year journey to bring to life these networks of trails called Buqat Lubnan.
The idea is that the Buqat Lubnan trails go through areas that are out of the Lebanese tourism map.
Mukhaiber enjoyed being in nature since childhood. He says the fresh air, the scenery, and the solitude reinvigorates him.
I love these places that you don't find mass tourism, where you are with the nature, where you feel while hiking that you own the mountains.
But hiking in Lebanon has never been big, he says. The first clubs or groups sprung up in the 1950s and 60s. At that time, the country was known as the Switzerland of the Middle East. Wealthy tourists flocked to its snow-capped mountains and ski resorts. In 2007, with some funding from the USAID, Mukhaiber founded another long-distance trail, the 280-mile Lebanon Mountain Trail, or LMT. When Mukhaiber went to these areas, he says, the locals were confused.
They used to accuse us that we're gold diggers. They didn't understand that we're doing gave it for the fun, for the adventure of it.
But slowly, hiking started to attract more Lebanese, especially among the younger generation looking for adventure. Lebanon has two main mountain ranges, one in the east and another in the west. In between lies the fertile Bakal Valley.
We have the four seasons. We have winter, we have summer. We have snow starting December till end of April and May.
ideal for all kinds of mountaineering and adventure, he says, as well as trekking, snowshoeing, and skiing. The book called Lebanon Trails that Mukhaber has been working on rely mainly on old routes created by nomads and shepherds.
I just connected them together and like worked on the marketing and gave a name. And most of these hiking trails are historical hiking trails. So they're here since the Ottomans, since the Romans. So it's like you have this mixture of culture and nature when you're in the mountains.
Mukhaber also puts together tour packages where visitors get to stay in villages with locals who feed them and sometimes even teach them how to make cheese or yogurt. The experience includes the practice of transhumans. That's when shepherds move livestock between summer and winter pastures. These interactions, Mukhaber hopes, will bring much-needed financial support to less touristy areas and help bridge gaps between communities.
It's beyond a physical trail. It's a connection. It is helping to write a new chapters in Lebanon.
Mukhaber continued his work on the trails during the recent Israeli bombings. The security situation in Lebanon is unpredictable, he says.
It's a struggle. It's like you are trying to walk or running against the water current.
But he's hopeful that a calmer future awaits hikers and the nomads in the mountains, which will in turn lead to more people embracing hiking and adventure sports. He wants these trails to become famous, like the Appalachian or the Pacific Crest Trail in the U.S. And even if none of that happens, he says, this work has already been a success.
This was an individual work. It was like a personal dream, my gift to Lebanon.
A gift to Lebanon and lovers of the outdoors. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
This weekend in Boston, Nigeria will be in full effect with part of its community in the city celebrating with dance, music, and traditional food. It is the big annual festival of Igbo culture. Igbo people comprise one of the three largest ethnic groups in Nigeria. GBH's Trajan Warren has our story.
That's Boston-based Igbo artist Echezona Onwuama during last year's Igbo Day Festival. He's chanting, "Igbo children unite, all of us unite." Unity is the theme of this year's celebrations, and it's what Onwuama hopes to spread with his music.
That's like my mission in my artistry, and I've realized that, and that comes from the pride I have in wearing it proudly to be, you know, from where I'm from in Igbo land.
Igbo Day in the Boston area is a tradition that has been around since 1992. The most recent census data estimates more than 3,000 Igbo speakers in Massachusetts. Local leaders say the real number of Igbo living here is closer to 50,000. Ejike Eze, past president of the Igbo Organization of New England, says the annual event has evolved.
In the past, it was really just people would gather and do a cookout and maybe dance and go home. This one became more focused on the culture.
The event now includes competitions showcasing various elements of Igbo culture, from traditional dancing to their attire. The event will also feature Nigerian delicacies.
People are going to really have a wonderful time, you know, tasting the Nigerian cuisine. Just talking about it makes me hungry.
24-year-old Angel Chezie will be doing face paintings as well as a dance performance. She says being able to display her culture on the day is a privilege.
If you remember the saying that there's no place like home, that's what this event displays. It gives a sense of home.
As a younger member of the Igbo community, she recognizes the importance of preserving her culture.
I think it's so important for us to keep the culture alive, pass it down to our children's children, make sure that everyone is learning how to speak Igbo, make sure everyone's knowing the dishes, making sure that the culture stays in touch and it doesn't move.
Like other immigrant communities, organizers say their members increasingly feel threatened in America. Chubabon Chubaweze is the current president of the Igbo Organization of New England. He says his group meets regularly to speak with members about their rights.
Even though there's a general fear in the community about the ICE, but that will not deter us from having the event.
Chibuweze's organization is looking to meet the growth of the local Igbo population by adding services and resources, says Eze.
The thing about the Igbo people is wherever we go, we take our culture with us.
He says it is critical for the Igbo community to keep its heritage alive and share it with their neighbors. For the World, I'm Trajan Warren.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Malaria is one of the worst killers of young children in Africa. A first-of-its-kind drug could help change that. It's made specifically to treat malaria in babies, and it was just approved for use in Ghana. But as the science takes a step forward, funding for malaria prevention and research is moving in the opposite direction, as we hear from reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, the Ghanaian capital.
Inside a three-bedroom house in Pukwase, just on the outskirts of Accra, Nadima Umar Uthman sits on a wooden chair as she dips a white towel into warm water and presses it gently on her baby's back. The girl is just 4 months old.
For me, motherhood has been a roller coaster of emotions. This is my third child. I have two boys and then one girl.
And that roller coaster includes malaria. Uthman says she first came face to face with the disease when her sons were babies, especially her firstborn.
Initially, I didn't know what I was dealing with. He had very, high temperature. He wasn't feeding well. And so I was very troubled.
Malaria is a life-threatening disease spread by the bites of infected mosquitoes. It's caused by a parasite called Plasmodium that enters the bloodstream and attacks the body, often leading to fever, chills, and extreme weakness.
The first few months of life, a new mom, you're trying to juggle motherhood and, a disease like malaria attacks your newborn. It's very heart-wrenching.
In 2023 alone, malaria killed nearly 600,000 people worldwide, most of them young children. And almost all those deaths happened here in sub-Saharan Africa. In Ghana, malaria is widespread, but many still don't realize just how dangerous it is for babies. This issue with kids is they often have fragile livers, kidneys, and an immature metabolism. And no malaria drug was made for that. Doctors had to repurpose medicine meant for older kids, exposing a serious treatment gap. Now that gap may finally be closing. Coartem Baby, the first malaria drug made for babies, has just been approved. It dissolves in breast milk, tastes like cherry, and has been proven safe and effective.
It's good news for us, and this is going to be the first time we are going to have such a formulation, so it's good news.
Thus, Dr. Hilda Mantibia Boy, who works at the Child Health Department of the Kolebu Teaching Hospital and doubles as president of the Pediatric Society of Ghana. She says the new treatment brings major relief, not just for mothers, but for doctors too.
I think that the burden of thinking about whether you are overdosing the child or underdosing the child is going to go away. This time you're going to be a bit more confident and comfortable knowing that it has been tested in this age group and is safe and is made just for them.
The drug was developed by pharmaceutical company Novartis with financial and scientific support from the Swiss non-profit Medicines for Malaria Venture. It comes after years of research, including major clinical trials in 8 African countries. USAID funding would have gone towards an awareness campaign about Coartem Baby. Also, indoor spraying, net distribution, and tracking and monitoring progress of various interventions. But beyond hospitals and households, the funding cuts are also being felt in research laboratories, especially those focusing on preventing malaria before it happens.
So when we collect our samples from the field...
At the University of Ghana's Department of Animal Biology and Conservation Science, researcher Fred Abuaji-Entri studies the genetics and ecology of mosquitoes. In his laboratory, he employs gene drive technology, a process that modifies the DNA of male Anopheles mosquitoes so that they pass on traits that either reduce their ability to reproduce or carry the malaria parasites.
Where the truncation of funding comes with truncation of research activities.
Abuaji Entry also leads the Ghana chapter of Target Malaria, a global research consortium. He says funding cuts have left many partnerships in limbo, and promising new studies have been shelved. One project planned to investigate whether certain plant juices, what mosquitoes naturally feed on, might weaken the insect's ability to transmit malaria.
And we had developed the concept, we had developed the proposal, and we were about to submit it.
Abuaji Entry says the study had the potential to reshape malaria prevention across Africa. If specific plants were found to weaken mosquitoes' ability to spread the parasite, then strategically planting them in malaria-prone areas could have offered a natural, low-cost way to curb the disease.
We view the gel under this. This one has UV light in it.
Across town at the Ghana Atomic Energy Commission, Nuclear Agriculture and Biotechnology Professor Michael Osain walks me through his lab where he uses the sterile insect technique, essentially mosquito birth control using radiation. Sterile male mosquitoes are released into the wild. They mate but produce no offspring. With USAID gone, the work here is slowing down.
So if you have to send people to the field to go and collect mosquitoes and collect data in the field for you, you need money. And if the funding is cut, then that work cannot go on.
Professor Jane Carlton, who leads the Malaria Research Institute at Johns Hopkins, says the funding cuts risk rolling back decades of global progress.
My colleagues who work in this area predict that the loss of all US funding will likely mean fewer vaccine introductions into many low and middle income countries. So it is very disturbing.
Carlton says pooling US support also damages American leadership in global health.
The US is shooting itself in the foot in terms of global health security and research innovation, and then also geopolitical influence as well. All of those are going to be decreased. So I think it's really a disaster.
In Ghana, researcher Michael Osain says the private sector must step up if the country hopes to stay on course.
If they can see that and dedicate some of their corporate social responsibility funding to support malaria elimination, we all would be able to win the war against malaria.
Back in Pokwase, Nadima Umar Uthman says she's excited about the new baby-friendly malaria drug and simply can't wait for its rollout in Ghana.
I'm really hoping that it gets to Ghana quickly and then we do not hear of children dying from malaria.
Scientists warn that without sustained investment in prevention and research, even the best treatments may not be enough. Because malaria is always evolving, and so must the fight. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman, Accra, Ghana.
The story was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. An announcement from Washington this week is stoking big concerns for researchers abroad. It's the Trump administration's decision to slash $500 million of federal funding for work on mRNA vaccines. To get a handle on the global impact of this move, we turn to Gabby Galvin. She's a Brussels-based health reporter with Euronews. I asked her to start by explaining what mRNA vaccines actually do to the human body.
When you think of traditional vaccines, the way they work is they have a weakened or an inactivated form of a virus in them that trains your body to respond. Whereas messenger RNA or mRNA shots are a little bit different. They deliver genetic instructions into your cells that basically tell them to produce a dummy or a decoy of the virus and basically prime your immune system to be able to fight the real thing. It's kind of like creating a wanted poster for the virus so that you can spot the bad guy when he shows up.
Got it. So the development of mRNA vaccines has been a global effort, but what has the U.S. contribution to that research represented? Like, what goes away with that $500 million?
Right. So I think most people are very familiar with how transformative the mRNA-based COVID vaccines were. The reason that researchers are so excited about mRNA is because you can use it to develop vaccines much faster than traditional kinds of vaccines. They're a bit of a plug and play where you can ramp up production much faster. And you can see that in a pandemic emergency situation where time is really of the essence, that is very appealing. And so that is also why researchers and the scientific community around the world are very worried right now about losing that $500 million in funding from the U.S., which has been traditionally a leader in this space.
What sort of reactions to this news have you been seeing outside the U.S., Gabby?
You know, folks are concerned, and it's concerning because the U.S. NIH, the National Institutes of Health, is the biggest funder of biomedical research in the world. So when the U.S. makes a decision like this, it really does have ripple effects across the globe, not just for the 22 projects which are affected by these cuts, but also for the progress in mRNA development more broadly.
Yeah, elaborate more on that. How would you describe the actual knock-on effect for research in other countries with this $500 million going away from the U.S.?
Sure. So maybe it would help a little bit to discuss how international research collaboration works for biomedical research. Basically, American scientists who get money from the NIH for various research projects, they submit a proposal for a study that they want to do, and the NIH says yes or no and gives them some money. American institutions get the money. They're the grantees. They can dole out some of this to partners elsewhere, but not all of those partnerships actually come with money attached. A lot of the collaborations are just based on professional networks. Experts in fields in different countries know each other. They collaborate even when there's no money. They're paid by their respective institutions, and then they do collaborate on papers together. So because of that, it's hard to say exactly what the impact of the mRNA funding cuts will be. But when I've been talking with European scientists about other research cuts from the U.S. this year, what they have said is that even that level of cooperation is going to be more difficult simply because the U.S. partners won't be at the table in the first place. They won't be the ones doing the research.
So you mentioned the European scientists you've been speaking with. Who are the major national players out there currently that are invested in mRNA research, and who pays for that sort of research? You mentioned universities. Are there any national governments that are supporting this research elsewhere?
Yeah, so Germany has been huge in this space. They, for example, spent $750 million to develop COVID vaccines just in 2020, 2021. And, you know, notably, they have the huge company BioNTech, which developed an mRNA vaccine with Pfizer, that COVID vaccine. And they're not affected by these cuts from the U.S. So they've been investing heavily in mRNA technology to develop treatments for things much broader than viruses or pandemic threats. They're looking at mRNA for cancer treatment, for example. So Germany is a huge one to watch. Belgium, France have investments. China, Canada, South Korea have all invested considerably in this technology.
I mean, is there any other single country that can take the lead on mRNA research? Or do you kind of see the U.S. suddenly out of this research and could be facing a global mRNA cartel?
Well, I think this is another reason why folks are so worried about this. $500 million is a huge hole, and it's not really clear that other wealthy countries will be able to fill that gap. They are having their own debates about how they want to spend their money. And in other areas in health where the U.S. has stepped back, for example, global aid for lower income countries, they haven't really stepped up there. So yes, there is some opportunity. There are some other countries which are, you know, I expect these other countries to continue full steam ahead with their existing research and the investments that they are making. We have had no indication that anybody else is stepping back from mRNA. At the same time, can they fill a $500 million gap? That will be very daunting.
Gabby Galvin reports on global health for Euronews. She spoke with us from Brussels. Decision makers in Europe are wrestling with a new security landscape. They're asking themselves how to protect their people in a world without American guarantees. One big part of that equation in the decades ahead will be energy security. European governments are racing to reduce their reliance on fossil fuels and generate their own power. Dan Ashby from our partners at Deutsche Welle, DW, has been traveling around the UK to learn about its tough experience weaning itself off of coal. Coal was the fuel source that shaped British communities and culture for centuries. Here's Dan with that story and the lessons the UK offers that the rest of Europe could benefit from.
Here we go, road to Aberdare, getting higher, higher and higher and higher.
Hundreds of years ago, Britain provided 85% of the world's coal. It's no stretch to say coal built the Industrial Revolution, so I'm driving back in time to understand what we've lost. I arrive at Beamish Living Museum in County Durham, an entire 1950s mining village that's been preserved with hundreds of volunteer actors living a 50s life. Pop in to the miners' cottages and you'll find a roaring coal fireplace.
It feels lovely and traditional, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I can see why they say it was the centre of the home, because now I see the full fireplace in its full glory. It is quite something.
It absolutely is. I mean, you would do everything on this fire. If you didn't have this range, then basically you couldn't do your daily chores, because without the range, you've got no food and no hot water, so...
Of course, I didn't think of the water, drying clothes. I just saw it as heat. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
The point is that coal was, and still is, much more than a black rock. It shaped the way our homes are built, our culture, even gender and psychology. And if Europe wants to close its 150-odd coal mines, not to mention ending coal imports, a good start is to fully understand what coal means to coal communities, as John Kindlysides, a historian from the museum, explains.
We shouldn't bury our heads in the sand and deny that we use coal. We should celebrate the fact that this part of the region was built on the coal industry, and a lot of our towns and villages wouldn't be the same, wouldn't in a lot of cases exist without coal. Yeah, it is. It's a very emotive subject. Any ex-miner, they all mourn the loss of the coal industry.
Britain's closure of coal was at times confrontational, even brutal.
He knows that this strike, started by manipulation of union rules, has been maintained by violence and intimidation.
Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister most associated with killing coal. Her government closed more than 100 pits in a few years, sparking the iconic 1984 miners' strike.
Hands up vote, unanimously, to go on strike as from Monday morning.
I've arrived in South Yorkshire with ex-miner and ex-striker Alex Matheson. We're walking around the edges of a new housing estate, but this was once the fields of Orgreave, where the strike reached its climax. Even now, as we've just passed the 40th anniversary of that day, it's still raw. This is the first time that Alex has been back.
So there were people on the field physically fighting each other, policemen and pickets. There were missiles being thrown, But I've never seen ever in my life as much brutality from the police. My heart were in my mouth that day, because I had to run, and I could run at that time, and I had to run. Since there were no way, and I kept looking back to see who were near me, and all I could see were miners falling to the ground. I'm a bit tearful now. Frightened me, honestly. That day, wow, heart were up here.
Within 10 years, 180,000 had lost their jobs, with little support or economic management. Decades on, the same areas of the UK still suffer intergenerational poverty, and communities remain divided.
Did people fall out with them?
Yeah, so people don't speak today. In some of the villages, some of them had destroyed the marriages, lost the homes.
All grief and the abrupt abandonment of coal communities in the 1980s has become the symbol of an unjust transition, where the poorest communities pay the price for an economic transformation. As Europe closes its coal power plants and moves to renewables, how can it avoid repeating that mistake? The good news is that already the EU has learned from the UK. The transition will be more planned, and there's funds to help coal workers transition to other industries. So the big challenge for Europe is to try to keep its coal communities engaged. There are some answers that Europe can find in the UK to all these difficult problems, not least in how the UK managed coal's decline from the noughties on. And that came down to setting a deadline and having a vision.
We're now standing in my office looking out across...
That's Graham Miller, the former council leader of the British city of Sunderland, showing off the view from the council building. Sunderland was built on coal and shipyards, but it's been voted one of the top cities in the world for climate ambition. That's in part because the UK legislated to phase out coal and subsidise the renewables market. Now Sunderland is planning to make its own electricity from wind and solar panels and to be carbon neutral by 2040.
But what you can see across to my right is the three Gen 2 tower blocks that are now using heat-sourced water to heat those buildings rather than having gas boilers in them. If you can see cranes, you're doing things. That's what people expect.
He believes that going green will bring money and jobs into Sunderland. And actually, being built on mines, because of all the water they hold, is an important part of the plan.
The water down there, if the ground conditions are right, it's about 68, 70 degrees, which is absolutely brilliant for heating houses and keeping everybody warm with a good source of hot water.
And yet, even with models like Sunderland and the UK, Europe has its work cut out. 25 countries will have phased out coal by 2030, but another 12 either won't make that deadline, or in countries like Poland, haven't got a full plan to phase it out yet. Even Germany, seen as an environmental leader, says it'll phase out coal only by 2038. The re-election of Donald Trump and the rise of the far right in Europe have both made speeding up coal's demise much trickier. And as I left Sunderland, I didn't have to travel far to find ex-miners who are already rallying against climate progress.
The dinosaurs were wiped out by...
a meteorite.
Which did what? Climate change.
I've made it to a pub in Gateshead, where I'm having an argument with ex-miner Dave Douglas.
And the species that existed before the dinosaurs were wiped out by what?
But
climate change.
But isn't that an argument to say we don't want it to happen again?
Of course we don't want it to happen again, but what I'm trying to say to you is we can't stop climate change. There can't be any rational debate with anybody on the subject of climate change if people think they can stop climate change.
Well, we could stop man-made climate change, surely, because that's self-evidently true.
We could if we all committed mass suicide. We could stop man-made climate change if we don't contribute anything at all. But to think you can run away from the greatest source of power in the world, we're not going to stop using fossil fuels.
The argument went on long into the evening, until I left, exhausted. Despite that, people like Dave are still in the minority. Unlike in the US over the past 30 years, the UK has cultivated that rarest of political things, a consensus. It is fragile and complicated and sometimes contested, but most people now agree coal is better left underground. In the northeast of England, ex-miner Eric Foster shows me the ropes by leading me into a dark, dank, huge drift mine, the weight of a hillside above us.
And this would have been loud. Loud, dirty, noisy, wet.
Wet. The machine itself is 10 times louder than a normal road digger.
Wow, and that's all day?
People, that's all day, 8 hours a day with that machine.
you want in there, you'll be working in there for 8 hours lying down. When we went to school, if your father didn't work in a coal mine, there was something matter with him.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it used to be like.
And now here we are, you know, end of coal, really. There's no big coal mines left in the UK. We know the environmental legacy, but it's also had a big cultural, economic impact on our country. How should we remember it? Should we be glad that it's gone? Or?
Well, personally, being an ex-coal miner, coal's had its day. You know, it's finished. We can just remember it. Kids don't know what coal is. They've never seen coal before.
But should we be glad that it's gone?
Personally, yes.
Wow, you're the first ex-miner who's told me that.
That's it. I mean, I worked down there. My father, he died of pneumoconiosis. He worked 40 years at the same pit. But he, at the finish, he thought, well, coal's had its day.
Today, coal's legacy in British life is both fading and instrumental. You can see its legacy in pubs and cities and so much culture. This journey has taught me that legacy is bittersweet for so many.
It underpinned the Industrial Revolution and these kind of rich, vibrant communities that built their own cultures.
We're a proud people, and our contribution to society has been unbelievable.
We clawed for coal. We built this country around coal, you mean?
That's Dan Ashby reporting for our partners at DW Deutsche Welle. The tennis world has a new underdog to root for, Victoria Mboko.
The maiden of Montreal.
At just 18 years old, Mboko won her first Women's Tennis Association title last night at the Canadian Open in Montreal. She entered the tournament as a wild card, but stunned fans by making it all the way to the finals. It was not all smooth sailing. Mboko even had a quick trip to the hospital to get a wrist x-ray before the final match. But she got the green light to resume play and went on to beat Japan's Naomi Osaka for the title. Mboko was born in the U.S. to Congolese parents and moved to Canada at a young age. That made last night's milestone victory all the more special, winning on home soil in front of 11,000 fans. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In the spring of 2019, Hong Kong was erupting with pro-democracy demonstrations. The sounds of those protests were familiar, clashing police shields, sirens, people running and yelling. There was also this. Do you hear the people sing? The solemn rallying anthem from the musical Les Misérables, a story set in the wake of the French Revolution. There are many more examples of Western pop culture that activists in Asia have hooked onto. Harry Potter, The Hunger Games, and rap music are all noticeable wherever people are protesting authoritarian governments, especially China's. Jeffrey Wasserstrom has been looking closely at this phenomenon. His new book is The Milk Tea Alliance, Inside Asia's Struggle Against Autocracy and Beijing. Jeff, welcome.
It's great to be back on the show.
So, Do You Hear the People Sing as a Hong Kong protest anthem? What does your research tell us about how that actually happened?
So one of the most interesting things about that song, it's been picked up in many different parts of the world, and it's often sung in both English and in a local language. And in Hong Kong, it was sung sometimes in English and sometimes in Cantonese. And the poet Tammy Ho wrote about this use of the song in Cantonese and said that actually, when translated into Cantonese, the lyrics mean "who has not spoken up yet." So it's actually a way of localizing and saying, of course, they're not going to listen to us, but don't you want to be remembered as the kind of person who tried to get them to listen? And this was something that was sung in 2014 in the famous Umbrella Movement, and then also again in 2019.
Yeah, and just musically, it's got that soft kind of determined cadence that underpins anger and frustration, right?
Yeah, and that's one reason why it's taken off in so many settings. It could be used for many different kinds of political projects. What interests me in particular in the book is the way people angry about autocratic rule in Thailand were watching the Hong Kong protests very carefully in the 2010s. And when they began protesting in the 2020s, soon after protests had ended in Hong Kong, one of the songs they picked up was Do You Hear the People Sing? And they also used umbrellas. They picked up some symbols and some tactics from Hong Kong as well. But to me, that reinforced the sense that I had watching images of the Thai protests, that it was though a pro-democracy baton had been passed from one part of Asia to another.
Yeah, passing the baton, a great, great metaphor. I mean, from Hong Kong to Bangkok to Myanmar, all with different translations, did the message and intent remain the same?
Well, I think there were elements of it that remained the same. There was always a kind of call for a more responsive a government to care about the people. So that was there. But one thing that was really interesting that was a localized thing in Thailand and Myanmar was that people would combine singing the song, which was popularized globally by a Hollywood movie, they would combine it with a gesture from another Hollywood movie, The Hunger Games. They would hold up three fingers. The Hunger Games is about young people standing up to a dictatorial regime and also worried about the pressure being put on their part of the world by a capital nearby that was riding high. So that could have an element that would play into the concern about a rising Beijing supporting these autocratic leaders.
I'm speaking with Jeffrey Wasserstrom, the author of a new book, The Milk Tea Alliance Inside Asia's Struggle Against Autocracy and Beijing. So you've mentioned the Hunger Games a couple of times, and we know that the mega theme of the Hunger Games is class struggle against dictatorship. Les Mis, also the class struggle. And governments must know this. So how have they reacted in Southeast Asia to these cultural artifacts, some subtle, others fairly overt?
In Thailand, the three-finger salute, initially the junta just didn't know what it meant. But then over time, they realized this was a claim that they were a dictatorship and began criminalizing even that kind of gesture. I'd say it's partly about class, but it's also about youth standing up against powers that be, older generation that have left things go too long. And in Thailand, one of the slogans written over the three fingers when it was sometimes put was let it end with this generation, a kind of call for youthful militancy. In Hong Kong, the three-finger salute didn't become as crucial as in these other settings I've mentioned, but there was a slogan adapted from the Hunger Games, if we burn, you burn with us, which when things really heated up in Hong Kong late in 2019, became something that was integrated into the movement.
Wow. So the title of your book, Jeff, The Milk Tea Alliance, tells us that it's not just about Western pop culture tropes that's uniting these activists. Who identifies with that label? What does it actually mean?
So the Milk Tea Alliance was a playful term that showed up in early in 2020. And there were already some of these connections between activists. There were activists in some in Thailand and in Hong Kong who were very interested in each other and even formed friendships. And then they thought, what do we have in common besides the fact that we're, you know, critical of this hyper-nationalism from Beijing? And they said, well, we're all from places where the iconic form of tea has some kind of milk in it. There's Hong Kong milky tea. Mm. There's Taiwan bubble tea. There's Thai tea. Each is a different kind of way of drinking tea, but they all have dairy and they're all sweet. And so it was a playful thing that was done online. And then it kind of took on a life of its own. And other places were invited into the alliance, with Myanmar being the most important example of that once there were protests happening there.
I'm just curious, Jeff, is milk in your tea a matter of taste across Asia, or does it have some colonial connotations?
Of course, it has some kind of colonial connotations, but I would think of it, actually, I would put it a different way. It has cosmopolitan connotations. It's something that only exists when you have both Asian customs, because none of these things are, none of the ways that tea is drunk in the places I was just described are the same as if you order a cup of tea with milk in it in England. It's all been localized in the same way, you know, that the Hunger Games, some people singing, do you hear the people sing, holding up three fingers is something that only exists both if you have the West in the picture and if you have local twists on that in the picture there.
Jeffrey Wasserstrom is a history professor at the University of California, Irvine. His new book is The Milk Tea Alliance, Inside Asia's Struggle Against Autocracy in Beijing. Jeff, good to speak with you again. Thanks for coming on.
It's been great to be able to talk about this. As you can tell, I love the subject.
That brings our hour to a close. You heading into the summer weekend now. Plan to be back with us on Monday when we'll get a taste of the intense heat wave that hit Milan recently. The situation tugged on threads of emergency preparedness, climate change, and political polarization also as part of the picture. Listen for that reporting from Milan, Italy, starting Monday on the show. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. Also, check out our reporting on YouTube. Make sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Marco Werman. Have a relaxing weekend, and thanks for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Steve Henn, Dan Shee and Ted McGovern, Sharon G. and Robert Ryan, and Frederica and Howard Stevenson. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PR.